My name is Kirsten Marchand. I'm a PhD student at the University of British Columbia, which is in Vancouver, Canada. If anybody doesn't know where that is, it's about 3 hours north of Seattle, so on the west coast of Canada. It's my first time at APHA, so I'm very excited to be here. It's been a very inspiring and exciting couple of days. And I'm also excited to be talking today about a subject that's very close to my research interests, which is trying to give voices to the patients who are in opiate dependence treatment and try to learn from their experiences and improve the delivery of health services through that. I have no relationships to disclose. And so I'll begin with a bit of a background and rationale, emphasizing why we might want to look into participants' perspectives with treatment, move into my presentation objectives for today, and then briefly review my study objectives, the key findings, and the conclusions and future directions. So when we conducted this research project, we were using the DSM-IV definition of opiate dependence, which defines it as a compulsive, prolonged self-administration of opiates in excess and increasing doses. And so what this means is when people stop using illicit opiates, they experience withdrawal. From the public health point of view, we consider opiate dependence to be a chronic relapsing condition. So there's many harms associated with it, both to the self and to others in the community. So harms to self we see what might come from mortality or morbidity related to hepatitis C or HIV infections, and then harms to others resulting from criminalization and social exclusion of opiate use. In Canada, so I'm going to now provide a bit more context to how treatments are delivered in Canada. So there are two sort of broad classifications of treatment approaches. I think fairly similar here to here in the US. But there's treatments that are aimed at abstinence, so that would include residential treatments, detox, recovery programs. And then we have opiate agonist treatments as well, the primary in Canada being methadone maintenance treatment. So these are treatments that are, I think, as many of you would be aware in this session, aimed at reducing the harms of illicit opiates by prescribing safe, stable methadone to substitute the use of the street opiates. So in Canada, and in British Columbia specifically, which is the province that our research is located in, methadone maintenance treatment is provincially funded and regulated by two colleges. So we have first the College of Physicians and Surgeons, which oversees the prescribing practices of physicians. And then we have the College of Pharmacists, which oversees the dispensation of methadone maintenance treatment. A person gains access, so the College of Physicians and Surgeons maintains a registry, a list of people who are actively prescribing methadone, and then a patient with opiate dependence can self-refer or can be referred from another community healthcare provider. And so then they would just go to a clinic wherever this physician is located and meet with the physician on a monthly or bi-monthly basis. During these visits, they have random urine drug screens, and then they take that prescription to a local pharmacy for daily witness dispensation. So at this time, especially in the area that we conduct our research, very few people are able to get access to takeaway doses. So as a result, the logistics, they're very close in contact with the healthcare system on a regular basis. Another important thing about our model of care in British Columbia is that the delivery of the services with the physician is independent of any mandatory or integrated psychosocial services. So as a result, many of the people in our community who are on methadone tend to be sort of managing their opiate dependence and their treatment by themselves, so just through the routine access with the doctors. So the area that I'm really interested in sharing today and that has been really exciting over the last couple of years is this idea of the patient revolution. And we're definitely seeing this sort of surgence of this in other chronic disease population groups. And one of my interests is in trying to link this with people with substance dependence and opiate dependence specifically. So in 2001, the US Institute of Medicine released a report that many of you might know here. It was called Crossing the Quality Chasm. And what the report outlined several recommendations for how to improve the delivery of health services in the US for people with chronic conditions. And one of them was to provide more patient-centered care. So this is care that really pays attention to the values and the preferences and the needs of the patient, the person, and then seeks to provide care accordingly. since that time, Canada has sort of followed a little bit later, but since that time, there's been a tremendous amount of work in the area of patient-centered care, shared decision-making, and most recently, minimally disruptive medicine. And studies that have looked at these concepts that are trying to define them and have looked at these concepts have shown that they are positively associated with treatment outcomes, so treatment satisfaction, treatment retention, and treatment adherence. So as I mentioned, minimally disruptive medicine is this sort of newer area that's sort of revitalizing the idea of patient-centered care. And this is an area of medicine that seeks to balance the patient's capacities with the amount of work that the treatment places on them. So when we think of patients' capacities, what we're talking about here are their abilities, their resources. So this might be personal, family, psychosocial, financial resources that they have in place. And then we look at the workload associated with the treatment. So workload being the side effects that the medication might place on the person, having to manage multiple medications, how to coordinate their own personal physician visits and so forth. So this area is emerging. It's coming from the UK, and then there's actually some pretty good research here in the US as well. But like I said, it's primarily been done among various chronic disease patient groups. So far, nobody specifically has looked at how this concept might work for substance-dependent populations or opiate-dependent people specifically. So in the studies that have been done so far, they've been able to show that that by balancing patient capacity with workload, we're keeping people more engaged in care, they're adhering to their treatments, reducing financial costs associated with dropouts over time. So when I first heard about this concept, I got really, really excited because I see that it could have a lot of value for a lot of our participants who are have multiple methadone treatment attempts, but who might have some struggles with adhering to the treatment guidelines. So this sparked my interest for the present presentation, which seeks to explore patient capacity and workload from the perspective of people with long-term opiate dependence in regards to their current or most recent methadone maintenance treatment attempts. So I did this using looking at these concepts using data from a study that we conducted in Vancouver between 2011 and 2013 called the Gender Matters in the Health of Long-Term Opiate Users, or GEMMA study, which was a cross-sectional study in the poorest postal code of Canada, one of the poorest in North America. It's a neighborhood called the downtown east side of Vancouver. It is a fairly concentrated, large, open drug scene, home to Vancouver, to Canada's first and only supervised injection facility. So lots of people, openly using opiates. The study sample included 178 men and women who had been using opiates for at least 5 years in their lifetime, who were using regularly in the prior 6 months, and who had at least one methadone maintenance treatment attempt. And with these 178 participants, we collected questionnaire data on their drug use patterns, their health, their histories of victimization, and their access to care. And then among those who participated in the questionnaires, we invited them on a first-come, first-served basis to participate in focus groups by gender. And during these focus groups is where we really explored more in-depth their experiences with the methadone maintenance treatment system. So we followed a semi-structured topic guide in these focus groups with the intention of trying to better disentangle their experience or their treatment needs, both met and unmet, as well as their barriers to staying in care and to accessing care, and their recommendations for improving methadone treatment. And so the final focus group sample size was, we had 6 groups with women for a total of 18 participants, and 5 focus groups with men for a total of 20. So for the focus group data, the analytical approach that we took, each focus group was audio recorded, and then immediately following the recording, we transcribed it verbatim. And this was done, and then the transcripts, were read independently by myself, the other moderator, as well as the principal investigator. And the intent here was just to determine what data saturation for the topics and the semi-structured topic guide had been reached. Once we had collected all of the focus group data, the moderator and myself then independently coded the transcripts according to the major topics as well as the emerging sub-themes. And then for the presentation today, we explored through the transcripts, so it was a secondary analysis of those transcripts, but we explored the topics and emerging themes that reflected perceptions of capacity and workload. So before I jump into the thematic analysis, I just wanted to share a little bit of descriptive data just to, again, give some context around who our participants were. So in the focus groups, the median age for women and men respectively was 48 and 50. Majority of participants self-identified as Caucasian, and then the remaining self-identified as of Aboriginal ancestry. In terms of years of regular street opiate use, women were using for a median of 10 years and men for 22 and a half. And participants self-reported approximately three prior methadone episode attempts, this contributing to about 31 total months in the lifetime on methadone. So when we looked at the emerging themes that might reflect the issues of capacity and participants' abilities to meet the demands of methadone, physical health, clinic fees, and stigma were the major emerging themes reflecting capacity. So by physical health, participants were experiencing primarily pain and then also described other physical disabilities that impacted their ability to get to a clinic on a monthly or bi-monthly basis, to the doctor, and especially to get to the pharmacy on a regular basis, on a daily basis. I mentioned that that methadone is publicly provided in British Columbia, but unfortunately, depending on the area that people were living, there might be wait lists for those physicians who are currently accepting patients. And so some were required to then go to more privatized, specialized clinics and paid in the range of $60 to $100 a month. So that's quite a bit of money. So financial burden for our participants who were on income assistance, so living off of, about $300 a month or so. So that was quite a bit. And then in terms of, the final theme reflected perceptions of stigma and discrimination. So this was in regards to their interactions with healthcare providers. And then in a few of the focus groups, people described experiencing stigma discrimination from employers and from family members for being on methadone. And so this was described as sort of inhibiting people's motivation to engage with the methadone treatment system or to stay in treatment. So then turning our attention to the factors that contribute to perceptions of methadone workload or treatment burden, by and large across all the focus groups, the most prominent theme here was the side effects of methadone. So the perception that methadone made people feel nauseous or lethargic and had feelings of depression and so forth. So these were seen, having to manage these side effects on a daily basis was seen as a challenge. And then in our context, having to go to a pharmacy on a daily basis was particularly a burden, as well as the long clinic wait times to see the physician. And then the third theme that emerged here was reflected in the dynamics of the interactions with the healthcare providers, especially around shared decision making with methadone dose. So a lot of participants emphasized here that they didn't have a lot of opportunity to give input to their prescriber on whether they needed a higher or a lower dose, and that was seen to be a bit of a challenge. So in summary, the summary of the findings, when I look now specifically at the transcripts from the female specific or the women specific focus groups, the same themes emerged by gender. It's just that there was some slight nuances in the emphasis that was placed on the different themes. So in the women's group specifically, there was a greater emphasis on physical health conditions, especially pain, as affecting capacity to initiate or stay in methadone. And then with workload, women's focus groups really emphasize the side effects and then the patient-provider collaboration, so the shared decision-making around the methadone dose. Among the men, there was a fairly high emphasis, high frequency of comments reflecting the clinic fees, as well as perceived stigma and discrimination from healthcare providers. And this, the employers and family, it only emerged in the men's group, so not in the women's groups. And then from men, the emphasis regarding workload was placed on the long wait times and the inconvenient clinic hours and daily pharmacy attendance. So this, as I mentioned, was a fairly exploratory study, secondary analysis of qualitative data that was focused on trying to better understand from participants' points of views what factors might affect their capacity, so their abilities to maintain or to initiate methadone treatment, as well as what factors influence their workload. And so one of the things that I think is really exciting about the results that emerged from this analysis is that although it's a fairly new area of research, the studies that have been conducted so far in other chronic disease patient groups, such as people with diabetes or with cardiovascular condition, they've also shown that time burdens and financial costs associated with treatment tend to be something that really affects abilities to be in treatments. And so I think it's interesting that even among this is a fairly specific population and specific kind of treatment, and yet there are some similarities that we can draw from those populations. So when we're talking to policymakers and as this research goes forward and expands perhaps in substance-dependent populations, there's a lot that we can generalize perhaps from the experiences of other chronic disease groups. So in terms of, again, it's an infancy, research in its infancy stage, so I think that it's really exciting to think about what kinds of research we can do going forward. So something that I would be particularly interested now in understanding is the relationship between the capacity and workload, so how they might interact with each other and how that might affect clinical outcomes such as satisfaction and retention in treatment. Likewise, it would also be valuable to carry forward with some more qualitative work to try to understand methadone patients' resilience, so what factors promote their capacity and reduce the perception of burden or workload with the treatment. And of course, this research, you know, we need to complement it with the experiences and the perspectives of healthcare providers and policymakers if we want to have any success at integrating minimally disruptive medicine in the methadone maintenance treatment system. So if you got as excited as I did about the literature, here are some references. And then I would like to express my thanks to the JAMA study participants who offer a tremendous amount of their time and stories, to our research staff, and then the funding for this project, which was provided by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research.